From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I speak with novelist Nicholas Prophet. Francis Ford Coppola's new film, Gardens of Stone, is adapted from Prophet's novel of the same name. It's based on Prophet's tour of duty in the Army. Filmmaker Jill Godmilow tells us about switching from documentaries to feature films. Her new movie is based on the lives of Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Prince's new album, Sign of the Times. And film critic Stephen Schiff takes a look at Prick Up Your Ears, Stephen Frears' movie based on the life and murder of gay playwright Joe Orton. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is writer Nicholas Prophet. Prophet's 1983 novel, Gardens of Stone, is the basis of the new film of the same name, directed by Francis Coppola. The movie Gardens of Stone stars James Caan, Angelica Houston, and James Earl Jones. The story is a semi-autobiographical account of Prophet's experiences with the military and the Vietnam War. From 1961 to 64, Prophet served on the Old Guard, an elite Army ceremonial unit attached to Arlington National Cemetery. He was part of the pageantry with which old soldiers are buried. Prophet arrived in Vietnam in the early 70s as a correspondent for Newsweek. Like the film, Prophet's novel traces the division the war caused on the home front. I asked Nicholas Prophet if he got the call of a lifetime from Coppola telling him he wanted to make Gardens of Stone into a film.
Well, I found out very indirectly. At first, the word I got was that it was going to be done by, I've forgotten his
name. One of the other guys.
The guy who did Out of Africa, Sidney Pollack.
Oh, yeah.
Which didn't disturb me much either. He's a fine director, too. But if I could have hand-picked a director to handle my book, it would have been Coppola.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that his other Vietnam War novel is the epic Apocalypse Now. And this movie is, it also concerns the Vietnam War, but it takes place in the Washington, D.C. area. And it's people in the Old Guard on burial detail. It's the exact opposite perspective than Apocalypse Now. There's no fighting in it. And it's also very sympathetic to the military.
Yes, it is. It's not very sympathetic to the Vietnam War, but it is sympathetic to the military.
To the soldiers.
To the soldiers, and especially sergeants, the non-coms, the so-called lifers, who came in for a lot of abuse in most of the Vietnam treatments. That comes out of my own background. My father was a career Army sergeant, and I went into the Army and spent 3 years in it before I went to college. And I ended up a sergeant, buck sergeant, a low one. But so I've had this fascination with and association with the Army all of my life, and I thought that was a side of things that hadn't been told before. I especially wanted to look at the institution of the Army and get across the idea of the Army as a family and take a look at what the war did to the institution of the Army.
When you found out that Coppola wanted to buy the rights to your book, were you able to find out what it was that attracted him to your book?
I'm not really sure. I haven't really talked with him about it. I think the rituals. It's a book full of rituals, and Coppola's previous work has always had a strong emphasis on rituals. The Godfather movies, for instance, male bonding between my protagonists, that sort of thing has also interested him. He's a very family-oriented director. He's got a very strong sense of family, I know, both in his personal life and in his vision as a director. And I think the elements of family, of the Army as family, and of these people coming together as family members who aren't really related by blood, appealed to him. But I'm guessing for him. I don't really know, but that's what I suspect.
Let's talk about the part of your life that your novel, Gardens of Stone, and the film Gardens of Stone is based on. It's loosely biographical, autobiographical.
Loosely, right.
So you, in 1961 to 64, served in the Old Guard. Now, what is the Old Guard? Most of us have seen it, but I never actually identified it as the Old Guard before.
No, it's those background people you see in shots of the president when his plane lands or at a White House ceremony. They're the guys standing in the background holding flags or standing at attention. It's basically a ceremonial battalion part of the 3rd Infantry. It's one battalion of the 3rd Infantry. It's stationed at Fort Myer, Virginia, which is right across the Potomac from Washington. And it does many, many different jobs, everything from putting together a color guard in old powdered wigs and colonial uniforms out at Mount Vernon, to guarding the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, to providing escort platoons for the president when he arrives at an airport or takes off from Washington, to greet heads of state that are coming in. But basically their job is to bury people at Arlington Cemetery to render the final military honors.
Do you have to do the digging when you're in the old guard?
Or no.
Just the ceremony part.
Just the ceremonial part. And even that's broken down. There are firing party teams, and those are the guys that give the 21-gun salutes. And there are casket bearer teams, and their job is just to carry coffins. There's a caisson section which handles the horses that are used in the ceremonies. And then there are just marchers who march along as an armed escort.
Were you glad that while you were in the military, your service was in the old guard?
No. I mean, I thought it's a very spit and polish outfit. A haircut every other day, shaving 3 times a day, shining shoes all the time, uniforms pressed all the time. You couldn't even wear your shoes inside your barracks. You had to go in stocking feet because you might mess up the floor. You had to be ready for inspection all the time. And that kind of thing I thought was rather Mickey Mouse and didn't appeal to me greatly. I was really out of the service before the Vietnam War really got started. As I say, I got out in 64 and the buildup in Vietnam started in 65. So when I wrote the book, I had to I advanced the time a bit because I wanted to get the Vietnam thing in. I wanted to use Arlington Cemetery as a metaphor for Vietnam, as a final resting place for our casualties. And if I had been in the old guard doing those kinds of things during the height of the fighting, like the people in the book and in the movie are, I don't really know how I'd have felt about it. It seems kind of silly to be doing that sort of thing when people are dying 10,000 miles away.
In the movie, one of the sergeants says to one of the young men just arriving, "Welcome to show business."
Right.
Because there's so much ceremony and so much emphasis on clothing. And somebody else says that the old guard is the kabuki theater of American arms. Now, was there a lot of sarcastic comments like that when you arrived?
There were, because there are a bunch of there's always sarcastic comments from young soldiers, no matter what they're doing and where they are. There was a lot of toy soldiers talk. But at the same time, I think almost every man in that unit knew that the requirements to be accepted were quite strict. You had to have a certain military bearing. You had to be a certain height. I was very surprised that I was accepted into it simply because I wear glasses. And today, that's not really a hinderment. If you wear glasses and you're assigned to that unit, they issue you contact lenses and pay for it. But at that time, I don't even think contact lenses had been invented yet. But I wore glasses, and as a result, did not get to do any of the high visibility things like the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier or casket bearers. I was always in an honor platoon, and more often than not, in the back rank where you couldn't see me very well.
My guest is novelist Nicholas Prophet, and his novel Gardens of Stone has just been made into a movie. The military is usually seen as a testing ground for young men to prove their manhood. And I wonder if being in such a ceremonial position as the old guard made you feel like, well, I'm not really going to get to prove my manhood here, because what we have to do is spit polish our shoes and dress sharp and be immaculate. It's the kind of thing that's looked at as being very fey by men who want to prove their manhood.
Well, there wasn't really a hot war going on at the time. There were some crises. While I was there, there was the Berlin Wall crisis to begin with, and then the Cuban Missile Crisis, where there was a lot of anticipation and jumpiness and uneasiness about what could happen, but nothing actually really did happen. And we did have some advisors in Vietnam. In fact, most of the officers and senior NCOs in the old guard had been in Vietnam as advisors, early advisors in the early 1960s, 61, 62, that sort of thing. And the honor guard was, I guess, their reward for faithful service in Vietnam. It was seen as a very high profile post where a man should feel honored to be there. Number one for the officers, and it was, you were not very far from the Pentagon and could sort of keep an eye on your career at close hand, and who knows, maybe even meet somebody who could influence it. So it was a prestigious posting.
You wanted to be in the military because your father had been, and you wanted to carry on the line?
I had the idea originally of perhaps even making it a career, and my 3 years in the service cured me of that. I've had this love affair with the Army all of my life, except for the 3 years I was actually in it.
One of the characters in your novel really wants to go out to the front in Vietnam, and of course his senior officers keep telling him there is no front in that particular war. Did you ever want to, like, I know there wasn't a war raging at the time, but were you frustrated by that?
No, not really. I was never quite as naive or as gung-ho as that young character in the book. He's almost too naive, a caricature of all that martial feeling that young men have, which is countered by voices of experience who've actually been there. No, I didn't really have. The very thought of combat made me a little nervous. And when I got to Vietnam as a reporter and had my fair share of shooting fracases, I didn't like it very much.
Hey, before we talk about your experiences reporting in Vietnam, I want to talk a little bit about your reaction to the movie that's based on your book. Now, you've had the opportunity to see it how many times?
I've seen it 3 times.
So what did you think of the movie?
I'm not really sure, Terry. It's I'm so close to the material. The first time, I wasn't very pleased. That was my overall reaction. I was basically looking for the changes and where they changed the material around, and I didn't see it very clearly. The second time I saw it, I liked it better. And the third time I saw it, I liked it even better. So another 4 or 5 viewings, and I'll consider it a masterpiece, I'm sure.
That's right. But, keep going, and it'll be
that's
great.
That's right. Most people, if you haven't read the book, then you just go see the movie and you judge it as a film. If you have read the book, then you've got different things to balance off against each other. If you've written the book, you really have a lot of baggage that you're bringing into the theater with you. So I'm not sure. As I say, I like it better each time I see it. And I really appreciate a couple of performances, and I think both James Caan and James Earl Jones are superb in it. I've never seen them better.
Did you want to know, who's playing me?
There wasn't really a me. There was one me was me at sort of 19 years old, and another me was me at 40. The casting, I wasn't quite sure about the casting. James Caan hasn't made a movie in 5 or 6 years, and he came out of retirement for this. He really wanted that role, and I think I know why now, because he just disappears in that role. You don't really think that you're seeing James. You don't think about James Caan being up there. They came very close a couple of times to signing Paul Newman to play that role, and Paul Newman is a very fine actor, but I, for one, can never watch him on the screen without somewhere in the back of my mind saying, that's Paul Newman. Caan, there is no sense of this is James Caan playing a role. This is he just disappeared into it.
No, I don't think we've really explained what the story of your novel is about. Do you want to do that?
Oh, my gosh. It's a young man, a young soldier, whose father was in the military, reports to the ceremonial unit in Washington, and is taken under the wing of a couple of older experienced sergeants who were friends of his father, and they sort of shepherd him. Well, he's very anxious to get on with his career and get to Vietnam, as it's the middle of the Vietnam War. He'd rather be fighting it instead of burying its casualties, which is what the job consists of. The two older men are cautioning him and trying to slow him down and give him some sort of sense of reality. They've both been in Vietnam as advisors before, and trying to give him a sense of things not going right over there. They already have a premonition about what Vietnam is doing to the country, and more important to them, what it's doing to the Army. It's tearing their army apart. And they consider the Army their family, and it's a family affair, and they don't like to see their family in trouble. And they befriend this young man. He learns some things and doesn't learn other things, and finally goes off to war.
We'll talk more about your movie in a couple of seconds. We're going to take a very short break here. And my guest is writer Nicholas Prophet. We'll be back in a couple of seconds. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Nicholas Prophet. His first novel, Gardens of Stone, is the basis of a new film of the same name, directed by Francis Coppola. The story is based on Prophet's tour of duty in the Old Guard. He served on burial detail at Arlington National Cemetery. During the 70s, he reported for Newsweek. From 71 to 72, he reported from Vietnam. He returned there to cover the fall of Saigon. You know, one of the things in the story of Gardens of Stone is that the soldiers who are on burial detail all the time, as you were, their attitude towards the people who they're burying changes as they start to realize that it's them. You know, it's people like them. It's people who they know. Did you go through anything like that yourself? And I wonder what it's like to preside over burials of people who are totally anonymous to you. And it's a ritual you perform day after day. It's like theater, really.
You went through the first funeral was a very moving and shattering experience and terribly poignant. In fact, I think tears came to my eyes the first funeral I pulled. There's the full panoply of ceremony and the rendering of taps and the black stallion with the boots backwards in the stirrups and the rat-tat-tat of the drum. It's very moving. By the time you've done your 100th, tend to become a little irreverent toward the whole process. The Old Guard, we called burials drop jobs. We called the cemetery itself either the boneyard or the garden. And we were burying 12, 13, 14 people a day. I wasn't around to bury people when the war was going on, although my characters in the book are. I don't know what I would have felt if the people we were burying were our age. Most of the people that I was burying as an 18, 19-year-old in 1961 and 62 were older men. They were colonels and captains and sergeants, men who had done 20 or 30 years and had died from natural causes brought on by the kinds of illnesses that older people are prone to. I don't know what the reaction would have been if the casualties had been 19-year-olds just like myself who had been killed in a war while I was in a very cushy post stateside and these kids were over in Vietnam. I also remember the first time we used to bury infants too, children of military personnel, where normally there are eight men on a casket as a casket burying team. And when you've got a coffin a foot or 2 feet long with an infant in it, that was rather sad too. But when you first started doing it, it was a very poignant, moving ceremony. As you kept doing more and more and more, you became more and more cynical about the whole thing, and you made up little ditties and irreverent remarks that you were careful not to let the next of kin hear. But
what kind of ditties?
I don't know.
Fit or not.
No, no.
Okay. Well, you know, it's one of those really ugly ironies that while this movie was being filmed about people on burial duty, that the director, Francis Coppola's son, was actually killed in, I think it was a boating accident.
Freak boating accident, yes.
And I can't imagine what it was to film the rest of the movie after that happened.
Especially, yes. I was on the set a few days after that tragedy, and it was a very somber set, of course. I had expected maybe that Coppola would have shut down production for a while. Instead, he took off a day. They had a very nice service for his son at the Fort Myer Chapel with the entire Old Guard in attendance. And then he went right back to work and worked around the clock for a week. And then sort of had a little collapse, went into an army hospital for a couple of days, rested up, got plenty of fluids, whatever, came right back and started right in again. It became I think the movie became a testimonial to his son. But it must have been very, very difficult for him to, number one, losing a child is probably the worst thing that can happen to a person. And then to be spending your days following that, surrounded by gravestones and filming funeral scenes, it must have been very, very difficult.
In your life, you were in the military before the Vietnam War escalated, but when you finally got to Vietnam, it wasn't as part of the military. It was as a reporter.
Right.
What was your position on the war by the time you got there for Newsweek?
The position of my generation in general was that the war was a mistake, that it wasn't working out. I think it was fairly obvious by that time. I went to Vietnam with the idea of being an objective reporter and making my own decisions, but I think I was predisposed to thinking that the war was a colossal mistake, a misadventure for our country. When I left 2 years later, I had not changed my mind at all. I still thought it was a colossal mistake. I think that the way I got to my decision was a little different than before. For instance, I had a great deal of respect for the American fighting man and for the kids that were over there and what they had to go through. Not very much respect for the politicians and some of the higher brass involved.
You know, you were describing Gardens of Stone as in a way being about the military as family and the ruptures in that family that were caused by the war. Your father was a career military man, and I imagine there were probably ruptures in your family when you were against the war, especially when you were reporting from Vietnam.
Not really. I avoided all that
by being in Vietnam?
No, but by having my father die on me.
I'm sorry.
No, he died in 63. I remember it very clearly because I was home for his funeral when President Kennedy was assassinated, and I got called by my unit off of my father's funeral. He had been buried, but I was still helping my mother do some administrative things, and I got called away because they needed every available body to back at Arlington to participate in the state funeral for JFK. They hadn't pulled a state funeral like that for many years, so they were blowing dust off the procedure books and panicking, running around panicking. So in a way, I'm almost glad he didn't live to see it. He loved the Army very much. He was a veteran of World War II and of Korea. And I don't think he could have taken what the Army went through in Vietnam.
When you were reporting in Vietnam, did you spend a lot of time thanking your lucky stars that you were there as a reporter and not in the military?
Yes, of course. I spent a lot of time out in the field with the troops. And part of my job is actually go looking for trouble. I probably saw as much, if not more, combat than the average GI who was over there. But I never forgot that I had that option to get out, to bug out any time I wanted to. And I exercised that option a couple of times where I thought that this was a no-survivor situation and caught that last resupply helicopter out. And I felt badly about it, but not badly enough to stay. And one time when I left, there were about 15 people left, and they were all killed. And if I had stayed, I'd have died.
Were they all reporters?
No, they were all soldiers. And I'd gotten out on the last resupply helicopter.
Did your military training come in handy as a reporter?
Not much. I did not, as a matter of principle, carry a weapon. I was a reporter, not a combatant. I had some trouble with some of the units I went out with. They didn't want to carry me along unless I armed myself, and I just refused. And usually talked them into letting me come along anyway. It helped a little bit. It certainly helped in my reporting. Yes. I knew some basics about strategy and tactics and small unit maneuvers and that sort of thing. So it did help.
When you were reporting for Newsweek, you were already opposed to the war. Did you have any editorial problems with what you were reporting? A lot of people back in the States, hadn't been there and didn't.
No, I mean, I don't want to leave the impression that I was going to slant that reporting.
Mm-hmm.
To fit my bias. I had a a mild basic bias when I went over there that the war was a mistake. Nothing I saw while I was over there led me to think any differently. If I had found evidence to the contrary, I'd have changed my mind. I did change my mind but I did not agree with some of my friends. When I'd left the States, a lot of my friends gave no credit at all to the troops who were over there. They were baby killers and this and that. I had a lot of arguments when I came back with those kind of people. I wouldn't listen to that kind of talk. It was nonsense.
You spent over a decade as a reporter, about 4 years in the military, and now you're basically a full-time novelist, and you're doing well enough at it to remain a full-time novelist. Why do you want to be a novelist as opposed to writing nonfiction or continuing reporting?
I always felt that the canvas, the reporter's canvas, was a little too small for me. You had to be a successful foreign correspondent, which I spent 10 years abroad, and that's what I did, was report mostly wars and coups and earthquakes and third world disasters and that sort of thing. When I found something that interested me, my personal inclination was to stick around and look at it for 6 months and study it from all angles and really get it down. And when you're a foreign correspondent, there's just not time for that. You come in, bang, 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 do the story, wrap it up, become an instant expert in 48 hours, write a story that sounds as if you've lived there all your life when you hardly really know what you're talking about, then move on to the next trouble spot. And there was never an opportunity to actually light anywhere and really get to the bottom of things. As a novelist, I can do that. I can go and I can make that canvas as large as I want. I can tell the whole story. I actually truly believe that through fiction you can get a lot closer to the truth than you can through nonfiction.
Well, I wish you the best with your writing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for visiting with us on Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me.
My guest has been writer Nicholas Prophet. His novel Gardens of Stone is the basis of the current film Gardens of Stone, directed by Francis Coppola. This is Fresh Air. On the next program, I'll speak with diva Jessie Norman, so I hope you can join us. My guest has been novelist Nicholas Prophet. He's the author of The Embassy House and Gardens of Stone. Gardens of Stone, his first novel, has just been adapted into a film by Francis Coppola. It stars James Caan and Angelica Houston, and it opens nationally on May 8th. This is Fresh Air. Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting Radio Fund. Additional funding comes from NPR member stations and the listeners to WHYY in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up on Fresh Air, film director Jill Godmalow talks about bringing the stories of Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas to the screen. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Prick Up Your Ears, the latest film by Stephen Frears, who made My Beautiful Laundrette. It's about British playwright Joe Orton and his lover Kenneth Halliwell. Our rock and roll reviewer Ken Tucker says with the new album Sign of the Times, Prince has gotten back on track. And we'll have a news update from National Public Radio. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Time for the latest news. This is Fresh Air. You may have already heard some of Prince's new album, Sign of the Times. It's climbing the charts, fast. Our rock critic Ken Tucker says the record is Prince's most successful recent work. But before we hear from Ken, let's listen to an excerpt of the album. This is Slow Love.
Prince's new two-record collection, Sign of the Times, is being hailed in some quarters as this prolific rocker's return to the real world, to the steamy, sexy music that made his reputation in the early 80s. Over the past few years, Prince has had a bad case of psychedelic self-indulgence. He made a movie, Under the Cherry Moon, that as a film disaster is the rock version of Howard the Duck. He released an album called Around the World in a Day that suggested he hadn't even been around the block. With its woozy vocals and hippy-dippy lyrics, it sounded as if this 25-year-old had just discovered Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, and it, like, blew his mind, man. Of course, whenever an artist starts doing the stuff that made his initial reputation all over again, critics scramble to pump his hand and welcome him back to reality. Their reality. Much as I detested Prince's recent narcissistic freak-out period, I also tend to think that he's earned his eccentricities. After nearly a decade of record-making, he now possesses a mastery of modern rhythm and blues styles that is unequaled in his generation. Over the course of Sign of the Times, you hear echoes of James Brown, Sly and the Family Stone, Al Green, Stevie Wonder, and Marvin Gaye. But Prince has become the most important black rock star by steadfastly resisting the profoundly racist and profoundly widespread notion that black artists are influenced primarily by other black artists. He's already gone through a deep Beatles period, and thank heavens that's over, but Sign of the Times shows that he's listened carefully and well to white musicians as disparate as Led Zeppelin and Joni Mitchell. The song I'm going to play contains everything I've been talking about: a beautiful pop melody, a sly, stonish vocal, lyrics that suggest Lewis Carroll by way of Professor Irwin Corey. Here's Prince singing a song called Starfish and Coffee.
It was 7:45 on the line to teach Miss Kathleen. First was Kevin, then came Lucy, third in line was me. All of us were ordinary compared to Cynthia Rose. She always stood at the back of the line, a smile beneath her nose. Her favorite number was 20, and every single day. If you ask me what you had for breakfast, this is what she'd say. Starfish and coffee, maple syrup and jam, butterscotch clouds and a tangerine, the side on a ham. If you set your mind free, baby, maybe you understand. Starfish and coffee, maple syrup and jam. Cynthia wore the prettiest dress with different color socks. Sometimes I wonder if the mates were in her lunchbox. Me and Lucy opened it.
and a side on her hand. If you set your mind free, then maybe you'd understand. Starfish and coffee, maple syrup and jam. Oh, just like the one she draws on every wall, every school. But it's alright, it's for worthy cause. Gonson, I keep saying starfish and coffee, maple syrup and jam, butterscotch clouds, tangerine, inside of all her hand. If you set your mind free, baby, maybe you understand. Starfish and coffee,
that was Prince from the new album Sign of the Times. The only thing that's missing from that song is the X-rated romanticism that suffuses much of the rest of the album. I think it's what non-rock fans call erotica. It also works as good rock and roll.
Our rock critic Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is Fresh Air. My guest is film director Jill Godmillow. She's best known for her documentary film Antonia, Portrait of a Woman, which she co-directed with Judy Collins. Her first feature film is called Waiting for the Moon. It's based on the lifelong relationship between Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas. In the style of Stein's own writing, the film sets out to invent what might have happened between Stein and Toklas during the summer of 1936. Godmillow told me why she wanted to make a film about Gertrude Stein.
I'm a big Stein fan. I've read her for years and years and years. I think I would go so far as to say she's, for me, the most important innovator in the English language in the 20th century. I think everyone who's writing today in anything close to postmodernist is really in her legacy. And she's the one who opened the language, who really changed the way you could write. So there was always that. Then there was a strong fascination with the life, the living. In some way, they were the first bohemians. And I think that in particular, the thing about that was that she so unabashedly and with such good humor, with no announcements or labels of the life she chose to lead, lived it to the fullest extent, happily in a single relationship with another woman, with no fanfare and no urgency and no guilt and no statements to be made, just chose a life and lived it well, and that's pretty unusual.
Did you read a lot of Gertrude Stein's work in preparation for doing the movie?
I reread everything, and in fact, the film was not researched at all beyond reading Stein. We weren't interested in secondary sources or what so-and-so said about her.
Most of the incidents in the film are invented. The main characters are based on the real Stein and the real Toklas, but the incidents right. that you've given them are, for the most part, fictionalized. Why did you want to make up the incidents, just totally make them up for the movie?
That's a good question, because, in fact, it never occurred to us to do the other, which is the traditional, the biography, the docudrama, which is a kind of a cultural product that takes its legitimacy from the fact that it has truly represented the life of Gertrude Stein and the characters who were around them. And we wanted to make a film that took its meaning not from the record, but because it had a proposition to make. It said, could this be Gertrude and Alice? Is this what they would have been like if this happened to them? And so it was never in our thoughts to remake Gertrude Stein in cinema. I think cinema and history are completely enemies. As soon as you cast a Linda Hunt for an Alice B. Toklas, you're outside of history. And as soon as you decide it's 90 minutes and it needs a beginning, middle, and end, you're outside of history. You've narrativized something that was not narrative.
Usually in a film about famous people, the more famous actor or actress plays the more famous person in the movie. Mm-hmm. And in this case, Linda Hunt, the more famous actress in the film, plays Alice B. Toklas, who's the less famous between Stein and, right. and Toklas. Right. How did she end up in that role?
Well, in truth, we offered her Gertrude first. We thought we had to cast a Gertrude first because it was the harder casting. Given that Gertrude Stein, much more than Alice, is sort of known photographically, and there is a certain cultural myth about her. Everybody has a few ideas about who this woman was. And Linda Hunt was my first choice. I couldn't imagine another American actress who I thought could play Gertrude Stein, that you'd buy it. And so we sent her the script, and she called immediately and said she was extremely interested in being in this movie and would meet with us. And she walked into the meeting, and her first words out of her mouth were, "You're not going to like this, but I want to play Alice." She had her good reasons.
What were those reasons?
She has played and been cast, for the most part, as what I call the other in cinema, that even though she's a woman, she has played the woman who is different than woman. And I'm talking about cinema language now, cultural language. She's, in fact, played a man. She's played a doctor in The Bostonians, the only woman in a Western town. In other words, smart woman or genius and all that is other in our society. And she was interested in playing the more feminine role, the wife role. It's something she had never had a chance to do. And I think just for career reasons, it was important for her to play a woman. There are very few roles for her in the cinema, and that's a statement about the American cinema. But she certainly can carry a feature film. But she had to, I think, show that she could play that as a woman, not as a freak.
How far along are you?
Don't get them out of order.
Why don't you just number the pages?
I will when I'm finished. If I number them now, you'll just want to add a page, and then I'll have to renumber everything.
What if they get misplaced?
They won't, unless you move them.
A gust of wind might sweep through.
One already has.
I'm not so sure about this part. What do you think?
We've been through this before. It's fine.
I'm tired of typing.
I don't mind typing. It's the retyping. One grows tired of seeing the same sentences pass by over and over again.
Art is a struggle for us all.
For some more than others.
Stein and Toklas were lovers, and that's pretty widely known. But you had to decide when you were directing the movie whether you'd have any sexual aspects of their relationship shown on screen. How did you decide to handle that?
There was a little bit of thinking and rethinking and rethinking about that. It's quite clear that there would be a desire on the part of the audience to have the nature of their sexual relationship, if there was any, confirmed by a gesture or a shot or a... And in fact, in cinema, that's very easy to do. One shot of the bed that has two depressions in it as opposed to one would have been a sign to the audience is, oh, yes, they sleep together. Therefore, I know who they are. They're lesbians, and therefore the film is about two lesbians. And therefore, the problems that they experience in the film are the problems of lesbians. And exactly for that reason, I refuse that gesture, and I refuse the kiss or the shot where both of them are in the same bed. It's a statement about our culture, really, that you can't make a film where you show two women in bed without the primary identity of those two women being lesbian, and it seemed exactly the wrong thing to do.
This is your first fiction feature film.
Right.
What kinds of new problems did it create for you? I don't mean disaster problems, but problems to solve as a filmmaker. Things that you had to learn how to do that you didn't have to confront in documentaries.
I'd say it's completely different. The process is different. It's condensed and compacted and budgeted and scheduled in some way that that almost makes it more like the manufacture of shoes than like a process of creation. It's it has to do with money. The biggest problem for me was there's no time to think. When you make a documentary, often you're able to raise some money, you shoot some, you look at what you've shot, you figure out what its meaning is, you raise some more money, you go in a different direction, you keep developing ideas, you keep developing structure as you go. And in dramatic film, there's this thing called the script, which is a model for the finished film. All the creative work is really done around that script and in the preparation of the shooting, in the casting and the choice of locations. And then it feels like finally the money's in place, finally everyone's assembled, bing, a gun goes off, and you go. And there's the schedule, and it says you shoot these three scenes this day, and you do. Because the actors are going home in 3 weeks, or because you have to, because there's no more money. And it's out of control. You're making myriad decisions every day that are intersecting at certain points, and you're not sure about any of them, but you've got to just keep making them. So it's radically different. And then suddenly it's over. That was pretty frightening, you know. I'm sure one gets to feel less overwhelmed by it, by, you know, the third, fourth, and fifth film. But that was quite a different experience than working and developing an idea through a documentary.
Do you plan on doing more feature films, fiction films?
Yeah, I'm up for some more. I've been trying to understand my own instinct to make more because it's kind of horrifying. It's not fun, really. Bergman used to check himself into a mental hospital after every film, and now I know why, you know. It's hair-raising. And that process and that schedule tends to make you want to not take the chances that you should take. I mean, it's very hard to do something radical in that production system. You suddenly understand why there are millions of hacks in the business and why you see film after film that looks like 10 films you've seen. To do the radical thing in that situation is very, very difficult.
Well, I wish you good luck and thank you for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Jill Godmillo's new film is Waiting for the Moon. This is Fresh Air. Coming up a little later today, we'll have full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with the show's co-host, Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What stories are you following this evening?
Well, we have some more on trade today. You know, the Japanese Prime Minister Nakasone is meeting with President Reagan at the White House as the House of Representatives votes on a trade bill. And we also have Judge Webster, the FBI director, in the Congress once again at hearings on his nomination to be CIA director.
And you have part two on the story on surveillance.
Yes, in our surveillance series tonight, a report from Sandy Tolan on the network by which federal and also state government agencies share the information that they've gathered about us.
Okay, Robert, thank you very much. All Things Considered is coming up later today from National Public Radio. There's a new movie out by British director Stephen Frears, who made last year's critical success, My Beautiful Laundrette. Frears' new film is called Prick Up Your Ears. It's about gay British playwright Joe Orton, who was murdered by his lover, Kenneth Halliwell. Our film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
Prick Up Your Ears comes across the way Joe Orton's plays did. It's extremely sordid and extremely funny. Its subject is Orton's peculiar romance with Kenneth Halliwell, the aspiring writer who seduced Orton at acting school and then lived with him in a one-room London flat for the rest of their brief lives. When they met, Orton was a semi-literate street bloke. Halliwell initiated him in the ways of literature and lovemaking, pruning and cultivating his protege like a hothouse orchid. But Orton grew rich and celebrated, writing plays like Loot and entertaining Mr. Sloane. And Halliwell found himself languishing in obscurity. He became a drab homebody, the niggling wifey behind the great man. Finally, on August 9, 1967, Halliwell battered Orton to death with a hammer and then swallowed a fatal handful of Nembutals. Alan Bennett's nimble script doesn't analyze the murder, but it makes the reasons plain. Halliwell adored Orton, but he also envied him. And there was something else as well. It was Orton's wickedly detached humor that goaded Halliwell. It drove him crazy, in much the same way it drove the theatergoers of repressed 60s London crazy. They loved Orton, but they also knew he was laughing at them. Prick Up Your Ears is an inflammable metaphor for a certain kind of marriage, and what sets it aflame is its no-holds-barred depiction of homosexuality. This is gayness in the bad boy style Orton relished, replete with orgies in the public lavatories, mauve-tinted bitching, and even bevies of mutely willing Moroccan boys. Without ever being sexually explicit, Frears has made a revolutionary movie. His camera work is restless and swoony and very distinctive. He likes to whoosh smoothly down hallways. He likes to pace and crane, and his taste for wide, luxurious spaces recalls Vincent Minnelli. He gets a cunning, sexy performance out of Vanessa Redgrave as Orton's formidable agent, Peggy Ramsey.
Mr. Orton, would it be rude to inquire how you're managing to live?
National assistance, £3 a week. I'm afraid I've just come out of jail.
Excellent. Papers love all that.
Frears also draws a miraculous performance from Gary Oldman, who played Sid Vicious in Sid and Nancy. As Orton, Oldman has concocted a strutting, heavy-lidded come-on, head lolling back, chest puffed out. It reminds me of a bantamweight Mae West. But Oldman also reveals a younger, less cocky Orton, testing out jokes on Halliwell and pleading for the laugh with a bumpkin's fat grin, as in this scene, in which Orton and Halliwell set up housekeeping.
Neither of us seems to have any family photos.
I'm an orphan.
I always wanted to be an orphan. I could have been if it hadn't have been for my parents.
Oldman delivers a captivating portrayal, and the movie needs it, because Alfred Molina, as Halliwell, is as creepy and off-putting as his real-life counterpart apparently was. Huge, ungainly, and completely bald, Halliwell isn't a man, he's a walking, lurching monument. All of which hurts the movie. It's impossible to understand Orton's devotion to this creature, and it's impossible to slip into Halliwell's point of view, as the movie so often wants us to do. Even so, this is a remarkable film, and at its center is a remarkable performance. With his portrayal of Joe Orton, Gary Oldman confirms what those who've been watching him in British television and theater have long suspected, that this is the most brilliant English actor of his generation.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. And that's our show for today. I'll be going down to Washington tomorrow for a public radio conference, so tomorrow we'll feature two interviews from the Best of Fresh Air series. I'll be back on Monday with another live edition of Fresh Air. My guests will be ABC White House correspondent Sam Donaldson and South African novelist Nadine Gordimer. TV critic David Bianculli will discuss a documentary on the MOVE confrontation, and jazz critic Francis Davis will review the latest album by saxophonist and composer Henry Threadgill. So hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting Radio Fund. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistant is Ed Doherty. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Joyce Lieberman is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Jackie Byard. This has been the first week of pilot programming of our new NPR edition. There's one more week of piloting before our national premiere on May 11th. Your feedback will help guide us as we continue to develop the show, so I hope you'll write to us and tell us what you think. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.